Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the court. Our first case this morning is United States v. Harvey. Lieutenant Dempsey, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the appellant?
Yes, sir.
And Lieutenant Commander Wuzhou, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government? Very well. Please proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, members of the court. May it please the court. My name is Lieutenant Christopher Dempsey, and I represent the appellant, Hospital Corpsman First Class Rodney Harvey. Chief Judge Olson, I respectfully request 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
Thank you. Congress amended factual sufficiency review to apply as follows. First, an appellant triggers review by making a specific showing of a deficiency in proof. Next, the CCA reviews the record and decides disputed facts in a modified de novo review, subject only to appropriate deference to the fact finder's perspective in the courtroom and any findings of fact of the military judge. And last, if after reaching these independent conclusions, the CCA is itself clearly convinced that the finding of guilty is against the weight of the evidence, in other words, not supported beyond a reasonable doubt, it may modify the findings. The lower court's interpretation and application finding otherwise should be reversed. These three phases of factual sufficiency review are neatly contained in three clauses of the amended statute.
Could we turn our attention, please, initially to Clause 2 in your argument that there is still de novo review? You argue that with this new language, Congress intended the same de novo review as before. Then why did Congress use different language? In other parts of this statute, they use the same language. They retained it verbatim. If they intended for the same standard of review to apply, why didn't they simply adopt the language that appeared before?
Yes, Your Honor, and that is appellant's contention. It remains a de novo review subject to some caveat.
No, I'm asking something different.
Yes, Your Honor.
They used to talk about recognizing. Now they're referring to deference. They're using different language.
Yes, Your Honor. So it begins, however, that Clause 2 with weighing the evidence and determining controverted questions of fact, which is an explicit carryover from the previous statute, and this Court interpreted in United States versus Washington and other cases as a de novo approach for an independent reasonable.
Well, fact. If you raise Washington, as you just did, in Washington, when we're talking about the de novo review, we explicitly say in there, no deference. And then Congress in this new statute explicitly provides for deference. So why doesn't that show that Congress intended for there to be something other than de novo review?
Yes, Your Honor. Respectfully, the opinion in Washington is no deference beyond the admonition that the trial court saw and heard the witnesses. So there was a level of deference. It's that admonition that the trial court saw and heard the witnesses. So the rewording of Congress here of removing recognizing that the trial court saw and heard the witnesses and replacing that with appropriate deference to the fact that the trial court saw and heard the witnesses and other evidence is just a simple rewording in a full redesign of the statute that encapsulates that same standard.
But it goes to my initial point. Why did they reword it if they intended it to be the same?
Yes, Your Honor. I think there are several reasons. So they obviously made significant changes to the statute. They've created a trigger for factual sufficiency review. But they've also increased deference, not in this way that we're talking about, not in the way of recognizing that the trial court saw and heard the witnesses, but in deference to the findings of fact of the military judge. And they wanted to use a standard, it appears, with appropriate deference that maybe could work with both of those. So appropriate deference is just an encapsulation of that admonition. Again, it's while appropriate deference may be different, Your Honor, the caveat that it is framed on the mere fact that the trial court saw and heard the witnesses is significant. It's not appropriate deference to the finding of fact of the fact finder. It's appropriate deference to the fact that they saw and heard the witnesses, which is interesting because in the second provision there, that appropriate deference should be given to the findings of fact entered into the record of the military judge is explicitly distinguishable from the language that Congress chose for this provision. And again, Congress didn't choose the language total deference, absolute deference, or even clear error or something along those lines. It said appropriate deference.
But deference, by its very definition, means that should be presumptively accepted. How do we get from presumptively accepted to your position that there's still de novo review?
Yes, Your Honor, and that goes back to my point that this isn't about an acceptance of the fact finder's evidentiary determinations per se. It's an appropriate deference to the fact that they may have had a better seat in the courtroom than the appellate court does in reviewing the record. It means deference to the fact that they observe the witness's demeanor in a way that the appellate court cannot. And I think that's also critical in understanding why deference is only appropriate, because deference may apply differently to different pieces of evidence. For example, if there's a video, if there's video evidence and the appellate court has the same position as the members do in reviewing that evidence, the appropriate deference would mean no deference. The deference to the fact that the trial court saw and heard that evidence, the fact that they had that better perception, it would be void. And there are obviously several examples here that may fall in between that clean-cut video evidence and witness testimony. For example, physical evidence, Your Honor. For example, in a murder trial where a glove is found at the scene, the members would have the best perspective in witnessing if that glove fit the hand of the accused or not. And that's why that deference might be owed to the members, where it otherwise would not be owed.
So counsel is, not to beat a dead horse, but so the explanation that you just provided, is that why now in an argument you're saying it's a modified de novo review, because that's not what you argued in the briefs?
Yes, Your Honor, and I understand that my briefs were confusing in that manner. It's a modified de novo review in the same way that it was applied in United States versus Washington, at least as it applies to this clause. This court still has to weigh the evidence and determine controverted questions of fact for itself. And I contend that, especially based on the dictionary definitions of that language, this is a fresh approach to the evidence. You know, against the question of fact is defined in Black's Law Dictionary as a question of fact that has yet to be resolved by the fact finder at trial. That is an approach to a question without a presumption. Of course, it is then subject to that appropriate deference. And that's why I say a modified de novo, Your Honor. And that modified de novo may mean something else when attributing that appropriate deference to the findings of fact of the military judge that are entered into the record. And, Your Honor, going back to the language change from recognizing that the trial court saw the witnesses to appropriate deference for that fact, this amendment was also made necessary by deletion of the language judge the credibility of witnesses. It was essentially subsumed in that appropriate deference.
I guess I'm just not grasping it seems like a very artificial distinction you're making here. When you're talking about, as it does here in the statute, witnesses and other evidence, what else is before a panel in terms of making a determination of guilt or innocence? And if appropriate deference is being given on that all-encompassing concept, I don't understand the distinction you're drawing here.
Yes, Your Honor. It's not appropriate deference to their findings or their verdict. It's their appropriate deference to the fact that they may have had a better observation of certain conflicting evidence when the court is weighing that evidence and determining controverted questions of fact. And, you know, there used to be an explicit authority to judge the credibility of witnesses. But that, again, has been deleted, and I believe is subsumed in that appropriate deference standard. Again, implicit in the choice of the word appropriate is that it is not total or absolute deference to the credibility determinations made by either the fact finder or the military judge. It also expanded from witnesses to witnesses and other evidence, indicating that the court would have the authority to judge the credibility of both, subject to appropriate deference. And, Your Honor, to any extent that this language choice of appropriate deference is ambiguous, the legislative history on this issue, the Military Justice Review Group report that recommended this change, said explicitly that it proposed this language so that the authority to weigh the evidence and determine controverted questions of fact would be retained. And they sought to maintain...
But wait a minute. The MJUR report also says that the factual sufficiency review should be, quote, more deferential to fact-finder trial. How does that square with your argument right now?
Yes, Your Honor. And following that, they also said that they sought there to be differing standards of review for pretrial motions, for findings. It's not exactly clear from that statement from the Military Justice Review Group report, Your Honor, but my contention is that they're addressing that second part of appropriate deference, appropriate deference to the finding of fact entered into the record by the military judge. That would be more deferential to the fact finder at trial than simply recognizing the personal observations of the fact finder in the courtroom. So appropriate deference may have two different meanings between those two different applications. Appropriate deference to the members' perceptions and observations is one thing. Appropriate deference to the military judge's finding of fact could mean something else. And that's what the Military Justice Review Group report says explicitly in saying that they seek there to be differing standards of review depending on what is under review. And again, that goes back to why this is a modified de novo review. In New York law, which they styled this off of, the Military Justice Review Group report also holds that this is essentially a de novo review. In People v. Romero, the Court of Appeals for New York provided, without question, the difference between what the jury does, what the appellate court does, and weighing the evidence are delicately nuanced, but the nuances are there. Appropriate deference is an application of that delicate nuance, particularly under this appropriate deference to the fact that that the fact finder saw and heard the witnesses and other evidence. And that brings me to Clause 3. So Clause 3 reads that if, as a result of that review under Clause 2, the court is clearly convinced that the finding of guilty was against the weight of the evidence, the court may dismiss, set aside, or modify the finding, or affirm a lesser finding. That's a test that remains one of an independent reasonable doubt. And Congress explicitly delineated these three clauses to be operate independently of one another. This is a trap that the NMCCA fell into. They found that because an appellant has essentially a burden to trigger factual sufficiency review, that they also had a burden to prove their case beyond a reasonable doubt, prove an undefined burden that their case was not proven adequately. But that's just not reflected in the language of this third clause, which is the test for factual sufficiency review. Clearly is defined as in a clear manner, and convinced is defined as overcome by argument. So convinced in a clear way. The court must be convinced in a clear way that the finding of guilty was against the weight of the evidence. A finding of guilty is unambiguous. That's a finding of guilty at a court-martial. It's a criminal conviction beyond a reasonable doubt. And if that finding is against the weight of the evidence, The Black's Law Dictionary defines that term as of a verdict or judgment contrary to the credible evidence not sufficiently supported by the evidence in the record. Again, as this court found in United States versus Sills, the traditional criminal law standard of beyond a reasonable doubt applies here. This is the finding of guilty adequately supported beyond a reasonable doubt?
So just to clarify, based on your brief, your reply brief, and what you're saying here now, is it your point that clearly convinced means clearly convinced? In other words, it should not be shoehorned into some other legal standard such as clear error or clear and convincing.
That's correct, Your Honor.
You're saying Congress used clearly convinced, use CCAs, use clearly convinced as the appropriate.
Yes, Your Honor. Congress is obviously presumed to know the law when they enact a statute. And Congress's intent to change settled law should be clearly expressed. If they sought for clearly convinced to mean some other standard, even clear error, preponderance of the evidence, by clear and convincing evidence, they could have used that explicit language. Instead, they used clearly convinced. And that simply means, again, when breaking it down, it appears to be a confusing term, but it's simply convinced in a clear way.
Counsel, it seems a little odd that they would use all that language where you say it just means that if the court finds that the evidence does not establish guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, it may dismiss. I mean, why didn't they just say that? I mean, I know you can't really answer that question, but I'm just wondering. It seems like the hardest way to express a simple concept.
Yes, Your Honor. It may be a difficult way to express a simple concept, but again, if they sought to deviate from settled law, then they should have done so clearly. If this term has any ambiguity to it, again, the Military Justice Review Group report is enlightening. They didn't define the phrase, but they did say the court's authority to set aside the finding that is contrary to the weight of the evidence would be retained. In other words, they saw this previous standard of an independent review for reasonable doubt as an authority to set aside the finding that is contrary to the weight of the evidence. And they styled this off of New York law, which is labels their factual sufficiency review for a review of the weight of the evidence, which may be where that operative language against the weight of the evidence comes from. Specifically, when looking at the legislative history, as this Court held in United States versus Sills, there's nothing in that legislative history demonstrating that Congress rejected the trial-level standard of proof beyond a reasonable doubt for purposes of Article 66 de novo review. I think that principle holds here as well when reviewing the Military Justice Review Group report.
Counsel, how does clearly convinced square with beyond a reasonable doubt? Because, I mean, it just seems to me that if you decide that there's reasonable doubt, how can clearly convinced add anything to that? I mean, if you're already looking at reasonable doubt, it just seems odd to me. I mean, it's like the person was found guilty beyond a reasonable doubt at trial, and now you're clearly convinced that there is reasonable doubt. Why wouldn't you just say that there is reasonable doubt? I don't understand what clearly convinced adds to it.
Yes, Your Honor. I believe it is a little bit difficult to ascertain the meaning of the statute, but I think the operative language that the Court should be focusing on is the finding of guilty, right? That's a finding of guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. That's your traditional criminal law standard that should apply to a finding of guilty. And there's no other indication in the text that they meant to apply a different standard. Again, if they had
what
said—
What about the words weight of the evidence? I mean, that kind of sounds like preponderance. I mean, it would be kind of odd that they would pick that, but that's kind of what weight of the evidence sounds like.
Your Honor, in United States versus Sills, this Court explicitly held that the term weight of the evidence does not mean a preponderance of the evidence. If Congress sought to override that interpretation, they could have explicitly overruled, indirectly through legislation, United States versus Sills by stating it's explicitly a preponderance of the evidence. Instead, they used that same language that this Court held in United States versus Sills was not preponderance of the evidence. A party contending that legislative action changed... Yes, Your Honor.
I wanted to roll the tape back to an earlier point in your presentation. And I've been sitting here thinking about the appropriate deference idea. And you mentioned that, this is not absolute deference. It's kind of a modified deference, which had me asking my kind of untrained mind, what would be an inappropriate deference to the trier of fact and what they saw and heard, say, of a particular witness?
Yes, Your Honor. Inappropriate deference might be in a case such as this, where there's video evidence and witness testimony, and the witness testimony is dubious or wildly incredible, and the video evidence clearly displays what happened. It would be inappropriate deference to side.
But your view of wildly incredible is apparently not what the members concluded, right?
Yes, Your Honor, and that's exactly why it's just appropriate deference. But it's not appropriate deference to that finding necessarily of credibility. It's appropriate deference to the fact that they observed that witness's demeanor. If you review the record and—
But if they observed the witness's demeanor, they must have concluded her testimony, at least on the essential points in issue, was believable.
Yes, Your Honor, and this comes back to why factual sufficiency exists. Factual sufficiency review exists, right? We are operating as a check on members' panels in the military justice system. It's a necessary due process safeguard that the CCA conducts this independent review, weighing the evidence, determining controverted questions of fact for itself. And deference is only appropriate in the same way that the court made that simple recognition that they observed the witnesses before.
Right, I guess, and I'll leave you alone because I don't want to beat up on you, but I guess what I'm still stuck at is I don't understand how you could make a determination or assess a witness's testimony without taking into consideration their demeanor. You know, the beady eyes and the sweaty brow that the members or the military judge is looking at. How could an appellate court, any appellate court, not just the CCAs, how could they ever have a better vantage point than those members or that military judge who are actually watching and listening to the witness?
Yes, Your Honor, I do see that my time has expired.
Please answer Judge Sparks' question.
Thank you, Chief Judge. It's the exact same way that factual sufficiency review was applied before, Your Honor. You have maybe not that observation of the demeanor, but the text or even listening to the audio of the testimony may give you that same position in the courtroom. It's not quite as sitting like a 13th juror, right, because you're not present in the courtroom, but that's effectively what this type of review is you're deciding the facts for yourself as if you were an additional member on that panel as an additional safeguard, appropriately deferring to the fact that maybe they were present, but if there is something in the evidence that indicates that their conclusions about that witness or evidence's credibility was wrong, the deference is only appropriate. It's not total. It's not absolute.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Do we need to decide the trigger issue? It seems like there isn't much difference between the government and you're not contesting what the CCA did on the trigger issue.
Not quite, Your Honor. We do disagree with the CCA, not necessarily their definition of the triggering requirement, but in the CCA opinion, they analyzed the evidence in determining if a deficiency in proof had been shown. Our contention is, similar to the government's, that it's essentially a prima facie showing. You just point to a specific deficiency in proof, and then the court weighs the evidence and determines controverted questions of fact.
Do we need to reach that issue to address your concerns?
Yes, Your Honor, in interpreting, well, no, not quite, Your Honor, because here the court did appropriately find that there were two deficiencies of proof raised. So, no, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Seeing none, thank you, Lieutenant Dempsey.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Lieutenant Commander Rougeau.
Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, and may it please this court. My name is Lieutenant Commander James Wuzu, and with Colonel Joseph Jennings, I represent the United States. This court should affirm the lower court's opinion because it properly applied the plain meaning of the new Article 66 statute. Turning first to that specific showing, we agree wholeheartedly with the NMCCA's understanding of what that means. For one, the appellant does need to point to that deficiency of the evidence, but more than that, the NMCCA was correct in that the appellant also needs to articulate how that evidence creates a deficiency in proof. And we also agree that in this case, NMCCA applied that correctly in finding that appellant did reach that prima facie case. Turning to the second clause, the court now has an
appropriate... Can you please pull the microphone more down toward you? Thank you.
Turning to the second clause, we have the appropriate deference requirement that Congress added new. This is a change from the mere recognized admonition that this court laid out in Washington, and undoubtedly, as NMCCA points out, is a higher standard than before. As this court pointed out right now to appellant, there is deference now, whereas before it was just that recognized admonition. And we know from Salve Regina College and Zervos that deference automatically means that there's no de novo review.
But what about the argument put forward by appellant this morning that what you're really talking about is deference to the, not their findings, but their assessment of the witnesses and other evidence?
Your Honor, that does create a standard that is not de novo. That creates a standard similar to other appellate standards that appellate courts are familiar with, such as a clear error or an abuse of discretion standard, where deference is given to the finder of fact in that situation. So we don't have a modified de novo standard. That's not available to us under American jurisprudence, and the Supreme Court has made that clear. This appropriate deference standard gives more ability for the court, for the lower courts to engage in the record than the previous recognized requirement. And in most cases, that appropriate deference will be high. As Judge Sparks pointed out, the court isn't there. They're facing a paper record. They sometimes have audio. But they are not that 13th juror, and they are not able to see the sweat on the brows of the witnesses.
So what does the word appropriate mean there? Why didn't they just say deference?
Your Honor, it's appropriate because it's clear to Congress that deference will vary in different cases. In general, deference will be appropriate. Deference will be great simply because the jury was the one that saw that. And we can see that in similar case law from New York, where they afford great deference to the members who were there and able to observe the witnesses. It's worth noting that witnesses and other evidence are separated out into different categories for that appropriate deference. So witnesses as a form of evidence are qualitatively different than other evidence, such as documentary evidence. So whereas the court would owe greater deference to the fact that the jury saw the witnesses in person and were actually in the room, there would be less deference to the other evidence, such as documentary evidence, with the which an appellate court may be able to review on the same standing as the original finders of fact were.
So in that case, you're saying that there would be de novo review if it was documentary evidence or a video or something?
No, Your Honor, because the jury did find that the member was guilty, and that goes to the fact that the court rightly concluded that there is now a presumption of guilt. And that mirrors the language from Washington, which originally held that there was no presumption of guilt or innocence in the former factual sufficiency standard. But now, based off of the clear meaning, the plain meaning of this new statute, in which the finding of guilty must be against the weight of the evidence and the court must be clearly convinced so, we now start from a position, like other appellate issues, where we're here at the appellate court because he was found guilty at that court. And now, evidence needs to be presented such that the lower courts are able to be clearly convinced in order to then set aside the findings.
When you say evidence will be presented, there's no new evidence. It's just arguments about the evidence. I mean, it seems a little odd to cast it like evidence must be presented. I'm having trouble with that.
Apologies, Your Honor. The record is stagnant at that point, and it is a matter of argument whether the evidence in the court's weighing does meet that new clearly convinced standard.
But see, this is what goes to the issue of presumption, because usually a presumption, at least an evidentiary presumption, is in the absence of other evidence, we presume this fact to be true or prove this fact not to be true. But since there's not going to be new evidence, it just seems odd to characterize this language as creating a presumption.
Your Honor, I understand the court's concern about the typical meaning of presumption. However, the court was merely echoing what the Washington court said in terms of presumptions of guilt versus innocence. It's not that in the absence of any additional evidence that the presumption would be overturned. It's based off of the plain meaning of the statute. It's that based off of the arguments about the way that the evidence should be weighed, that the court must then be clearly convinced that the finding of guilty is not against the weight of the evidence.
So, counsel, you stated earlier that the NMCC decided this correctly, but with regards to Clause 3, the NMCCA also said that the appellant bears the burden of rebutting that presumption, as it were. Is it the government's position that is correct?
No, Your Honor. The government's position is that the NMCCA shouldn't have said that it was the appellant's burden. That's not found in the plain meaning of the statute. However, in applying their legal holding to the case, it was clear that they didn't actually hold appellant to any particular burden. They rightly found and held appellant to a burden to provide that prima facie case for Clause 1. But when it came to actually weighing the evidence, they didn't place the burden on the appellant in order to prove the standard as articulated.
Could I ask a question that I like Judge Maggs, I'm still bothered by this presumption idea. And it's not clear to me why the court had to announce that this new language had created a presumption of guilt. And I guess I'm, even from a more fundamental or rudimentary point of view, I should say, I always thought, and in most jurisdictions, when a case is concluded at the trial and the findings of guilty are entered, the accused is considered to be, in fact, guilty.
Yes, Your Honor.
And so when it arrives at the appellate court, That's not really a presumption. It's a fact at that point. So I don't understand how this presumption idea is supposed to work in the minds of the CCA panel who are now engaged in their factual sufficiency review.
Yes, Your Honor, 2 points. The first is that presumption in that context is perhaps not used in the most artful sense. However, it is legally correct, and it's difficult to compare this with other jurisdictions because the military is one of the few jurisdictions that engages in factual sufficiency, the others being Utah, Ohio, and New York, Utah only to a certain extent for bench trials. But the fact is that even if the CCA said, even though the CCA said presumption of guilt, mm-hmm. that's less than saying that he was already found guilty. That's just an acknowledgement that they are able to set aside findings of guilt, given if they're clearly convinced by the weight of the evidence. Mm-hmm.
So is it that they're now, if they decide or reach a point where they're going to conduct a factual sufficiency review, in other words, that has been triggered, do they now sit back and say, all right, notwithstanding the fact that the accused has in fact been found guilty, for our sufficiency review at this point, our analysis now, we're going to use this presumption? Is that how this is supposed to work?
Your Honor, it's that we're only at the appellate court because the member was found guilty, and so now the court weighs the evidence in order to determine whether that finding of guilty is against the weight of the evidence in accordance with the plain meaning. The fact that the word presumption isn't in the statute is telling. However, the court really was mirroring what Washington said from this court about presumptions of guilt or innocence neither being the case in the former standard. So they were acknowledging that the statute had changed and that the Washington standard no longer applied.
But when you do when they or we do a legal sufficiency review, we don't presume that the accused is guilty. The fact is a matter of fact that the accused is guilty, and the only question is whether or not the finding can withstand the legal review that a particular court is about to undertake. So there's no presumption.
Correct, Your Honor. There's no presumption when it comes to legal sufficiency review, which is de novo.
Is that really the key here, that because legal sufficiency is de novo and this is not, is that why this presumption?
No, Your Honor. The analysis for legal sufficiency shouldn't be considered in factual sufficiency. They are different mm-hmm. creatures. One is well-developed from jurisprudence, and the other has just been given to us from Congress. And we're looking at the plain meaning of Article 66 to look at factual sufficiency. In the same way that Congress could change legal sufficiency and override jurisprudence, they've chosen to create a new factual sufficiency standard for us. And we know from Abney that criminal law appeals in the United States didn't exist at common law and aren't part of the Constitution. So everything that Congress says has meaning, including the deletions, which gets me to the point about the fact that the lower courts no longer have the ability to make credibility determinations of witnesses.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So with regard to the lack of the ability to make credibility of determination of witnesses, that no longer exists. We know from cases such as Choctaw Nation that when Congress removes language from a previous version, it no longer applies. And as I mentioned before, because criminal law appeals didn't exist at common law, there's nothing else to base this on other than the statutory nature of criminal law appeals.
What do we make then of the language in Clause 2 that the court is to weigh the evidence and determine controverted questions of fact? If the appellant has met the triggering requirements in Clause 1, and as in this case, the controverted part of the controverted questions of fact is in fact the credibility of the witness. How is the CCA to perform their Clause 2 responsibilities without weighing the credibility? As Judge Sparks noted earlier, that's all wrapped into the sufficiency of that evidence.
2 points, Your Honor. The first is that the CCAs are able to legally look at the jury's the members' determination of the credibility of the witnesses. However, if it
But as you just said, that's a different standard. So legal sufficiency versus factual sufficiency. So, okay.
So because they're able to look at as part of their factual sufficiency review, though, they do have the ability to evaluate whether the members' credibility determinations were correct. But we know from the plain meaning, the second point is that we know from the plain meaning of the statute that it was removed. It used to stand between the clauses about weigh the evidence, comma, judge the credibility of evidence of the witnesses and determine controverted questions of fact. And that's been completely removed, and now it says weigh the evidence and determine controverted questions of fact. And removals mean things. We know that because they've removed it, that that's no longer a power given to the CCAs. So insofar as the CCAs may find themselves curtailed and their authority curtailed by that removal, that's unfortunately second to the plain meaning of the statute.
How can a CCA weigh the evidence without judging the credibility of the witness?
Your Honor, there's other evidence involved, of course. But when it comes to the witnesses themselves, they're most of the time going to be constricted to what the members found in terms of those witnesses' credibilities.
I'm sorry. What if you have two witnesses, A and B, and A says, I saw him do it, and B says, I saw him not do it?
Your Honor, in a situation like that, if he was convicted, then that means that the members gave credit to the inculpatory witness and discredited the exculpatory evidence. In more nuanced cases...
Well, I understand that that's what that means, but, I mean, how are you weighing the evidence as we've got testimony that he didn't do it?
So, Your Honor, it would be that we could think of this in terms of a sliding scale. On one end is the government's end, and one end is the then accused's end. And that one witness might be placed one place on the scale, and the contradicting evidence could be placed on the other part of the scale. And that's how the court would weigh the evidence if those are the two witnesses, if those are the only pieces of evidence that are present in the record. But inevitably, in these cases, there's usually other evidence as well that the courts
have
to weigh.
But we have a lot of, you know, the accused said one thing and the victim says another thing, and, you know, he said, she said, well, however you want to phrase it, it's often you have to decide who's telling the truth and who isn't telling the truth, and the whole point of weighing the evidence would be meaningless if you just said, well, that's what the court martial decided.
Unfortunately, unfortunately, that's what we have for the plain meaning of the statute. Congress removed that ability to weigh the credibility of witnesses. So when we have the two, the sort of.
But the question is, when it says weigh the evidence, why isn't it weigh the credibility? Why isn't credibility included in that? That's how people ordinarily weigh evidence.
Well, we know from FDA v. Brown that statutes have to be read as one harmonious whole. So when we were talking about the old factual sufficiency standard, we knew that determine the credibility of witnesses was a separate grant of authority to the CCAs than weigh the evidence. And since that's been taken out, we also know that Congress intended to maintain the weigh the evidence capabilities but remove the judicial credibility determinations.
So, counsel, you said in response to my question in the same topic that it is not that the CCA is weighing the credibility of the testimony of an individual witness, but that the CCA would be assessing the findings by the finder of fact with regards to the credibility, meaning that if they obviously believe that witness to be credible, so then wouldn't that bump us then into the second part of Clause 2, which talks about the appropriate deference to the findings of fact, and that gets us, circles back to that, well, what would be an inappropriate deference in that instance? That's similar to Judge Maggs's question.
Yes, Your Honor. And appropriate deference, the appropriate part is largely left up to the lower courts because it doesn't go with further clarification in the statute. However, we do know from other courts that the deference will be generally very high, given that the members were there in person to see the witnesses actually testify.
How is your standard review different from legal sufficiency if you don't weigh the credibility of the evidence?
Your Honor, even though the standards have a certain amount of overlap, they are different. The legal sufficiency standard is de novo, you know, given all the evidence in the light most favorable to the government, whereas for factual sufficiency, we now have the triggering requirement. And beyond that, the government, the CCA rightly pointed out that now they must be clearly convinced that the guilty finding is against the weight of the evidence. So even though there might be some overlap, that doesn't mean that they're the same standard. They use different words in different contexts.
Your colleague answered this question. So what, in the government's view, is what work is the clearly convinced doing, right? So if it just said is against the weight of the evidence, I think we'd interpret that as saying, is it not, can you not establish doubt beyond a reasonable, guilt beyond a reasonable doubt? So what does clearly convinced, how does it modify that?
Your Honor, clearly convinced, it goes to the quality of the lower court's determination. And we know from other cases that look at the word clearly, that means a definite and firm conviction. Normally, that's in the case of clear error, of course. But in Utah, where they look at the clear weight of the evidence, they use the same definite and firm conviction definition. So it does have import in this realm as well. When it comes to the weight of the evidence part, it is a preponderance of the evidence standard. And we know that from, again, Hickman v. Texas, we're looking at similar usage in different jurisdictions. With regard to federal courts' use of the weight of the evidence in Rule 33 proceedings, that's defined as preponderate against the verdict. So we do say that that's preponderance of the evidence.
So you're saying that can you repeat that last statement about preponderance of the evidence?
So when it comes to I see that I'm running out of time. May I answer the question?
Please do.
So when it comes to the ability to weigh the evidence and then be convinced that the court be convinced that the finding of guilty is against the weight of the evidence, that weight of the evidence in that third clause can be seen as preponderate from the use of the similar words weight of the evidence in Rule 33 case law in federal courts.
What would that mean in a specific case, like in this case? What would the CCA have to determine in order to set aside the finding of guilt?
It would have to be that essentially that the members couldn't have found guilt by a 51% standard, a general preponderance standard. It's not the clearest standard, of course, but further litigation will clear out what is preponderate.
Any further questions? Seeing none, thank you, Lieutenant Commander Wuzhou. Lieutenant Dempsey.
Thank you, Your Honor. Review of the plain language of the statute indicates that Congress clearly intended to change factual sufficiency review in two ways. They added a triggering requirement where previously there was none, and that's a sweeping change. An appellant now has to point to specific deficiency in proof to trigger this review. But they also added appropriate deference to the finding of fact to the military judge. And again, a significant change. The prior statute did not call for any deference to the findings of the military judge unless they were acting as the fact finder. And the core of factual sufficiency review is the same. It's a modified de novo review. The court can judge the credibility of witnesses subject only to appropriate deference in the same way that it can weigh the evidence and determine controverted questions of fact. And this, again, is a test for independent, reasonable doubt. If a finding of guilty at a court-martial was by a preponderance of the evidence, this may be a different question. But it's about whether it was a finding of guilty is supported beyond a reasonable doubt. And as to the government's contention that this is about the greater weight of the evidence or the manifest weight of the evidence or the clear weight of the evidence, Black's Law Dictionary, when defining weight of the evidence, explicitly distinguishes greater weight of the evidence and manifest weight of the evidence from its definition. That's because that's a different standard, and Congress did not intend to adopt it. Policy holds that factual sufficiency review is a necessary check on military courts-martial. It's a due process consideration. It's part of the fundamental reason we don't have unanimous jury verdicts. The legislative history from the Military Justice Review Group makes clear that they sought to modernize factual sufficiency review, make it more transparent, and provide statutory standards for that review. And that's all that the plain language of the statute reflects.
Counsel, can we go back to your statement about the appropriate deference to the findings of fact entered into the record by the military judge? Can you just explain that again, that previously there was no deference to findings of fact by the military judge unless they were to the findings of guilt? Wouldn't they ordinarily be clearly erroneous if it wasn't part of the findings of guilt?
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor. And it's not clear exactly what appropriate deference means in this context. They didn't use the language clearly erroneous. They explicitly sought to maintain this appropriate deference standard that could be flexible depending on maybe the nature of the finding of fact. And Your Honor, I do see that I'm out of time.
Please finish your response.
Thank you, Your Honor. And this could be specifically seen, for example, maybe more deference is owed to the finding of fact of the military judge if they were to make special findings on a finding of guilt than their findings of fact in a pretrial motion. And that's why that appropriate deference standard may be flexible and may offer differing standards of review like the Military Justice Review Group sought.
Any further questions? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Members.
Case is now submitted. Court thanks counsel for both sides. And the court will stand in recess until 10:30.
All rise. The court stands in recess until 10:30.